do a global search for Audacity or whatever it is, and then you'll find the actual file somewhere. And when you find those files, it looks like it's telling you there's going to be a folder called like temporary items, and it should be in there.
All right, and I'll take a look.
I can take it. I'll look with you when you.
Okay. Are thanks.
Ready.
Nice. Yeah, it's annoying.
Well, I don't want the one happening now.
I've been talking
that we use
rather
than
powder. I can make any sort of recommendation.
Oh, that's a bad idea. I mean, I will, because I'm full of bad ideas. But.
Yeah, I don't
want to
get pegged in the head if
I don't have
one. Although that is on my top
10 list. Really? I can make that happen right now.
Right now. Right?
Shut up. Yeah.
If I swear on everything.
All right.
I swear we're
back.
With a donut.
Some more assumptions. The infant is in the middle school theoreticians. The infant's pre-wired for adaptation to the environment and to adjust to the environment, rather than the infant being initially psychotic, right? Hallucinating. Splitting, persecutory breasts, idealizing, rescuing breasts. You know, that's kind of psychotic, right? And depressed. For the middle school theoreticians, the infant is pre-wired to be adaptive and pre-wired for social interactions. It's a very different way of looking at a baby, right? You know, the baby thinking that the breast is persecuting them. You know, if we heard that from an adult, we label them paranoid. But babies, according to the middle school theoreticians, are ready and primed for social relationships from the very beginning. They're already pre-adapted, so to speak. So, repression for the middle school consists of making unconscious certain aspects of the caregiver-infant relationship rather than exclusively traumatic memories or forbidden impulses. So for Freud, it was forbidden impulses. I'm going to repress those. For the middle school theoreticians, repression is I'm going to repress those aspects of the relationship that are painful to me, namely rejecting and abandoning aspects, which we'll talk about. So let's talk about Fairbairn, William Fairbairn. So let's talk about his developmental theory. So the baby is born, and the baby starts out with a whole harmonious ego. Now for Klein, right, the ego is split into a lot of different parts, and so is the object, into good and bad. But for Fairbairn, actually the baby starts in this kind of nirvana with a whole ego and a whole object. So let me diagram this. And it's a very interesting theory because it's so radically different from Freud or Klein. And yet it's an object relations theory, so we're studying it. Fairbairn believed that ego began as this harmonious whole, there's no splitting or anything like that, and the object, the mother, is whole. Now, for Fairbairn, the baby is born and there are no objects in the child's mind initially. Right, for Klein, there were. You're born with this kind of a hardwired image of a breast and of a penis in your mind. You're born with that. It's a phylogenetic heritage. For Fairbairn, he said, no, there is no objects in a child's mind when they're born. They're born ready to interact with the external world as it really is. And if you were to push Fairbairn on this, and if he were alive, he'd probably say babies are the only ones who can really determine what reality is. It's adults who are screwed up. Babies initially are born able to see the world for what it really is. But what happens is that as the baby grows and matures, the mother separates from the baby, right? The mother can't be there all the time. So what was this exchange in reality, this is a real life connection that the baby has made with the mother. The mother in reality, not the mother in the infant's mind. This is not Kleinian theory. This is the mother in flesh and blood mother. I am interacting with somebody in reality, in flesh and blood. I have an interaction with you. Right? Mm-hmm. What happens is that this object is very gratifying, right? And the object is gratifying the oral needs of the child, of the self. But as you know, there's no mother who's a perfect mom, and even if the mother were perfect, would you really want a mother who's constantly there, ready with the breast at any given moment? That's not how reality, that's not how we interact as human beings. So the mother leaves sometimes. Sometimes she's late with the bottle or the breast. What does that do to the infant? The infant then internalizes the object. Say this is the mind, then. Psyche. So the object, let's say the object, this is the object in reality. So the ego had a relationship with the object in reality, the mother. But the mother started separating from the child. The mother started withholding the breast or ran out of milk or whatever. It's not so much that the milk was important. The milk for Fairbairn was a channel or a mode of relating. It happened to be the mode that's the most popular for infants, but that's just the way in which the child and mother interact with each other and relate to each other. So the object seeking comes through the mouth. But it's not the gratification of the oral drive that's important to Fairbairn. It's just a mode through which object seeking and object contact occurs. You get the distinction. It's very subtle, but it's important. So when this interaction is broken by the mother, having to go to work or whatever, the infant experiences separation anxiety and this feeling of utter helplessness and dependence. So what does the infant do? The infant then introjects the object into the psyche, into the mind. So now the object is inside the mind of the baby. And that's how objects are born. They don't come on board automatically. They're internalized by the baby to protect against the feeling of utter dependence and helplessness that the baby is going to inevitably experience because the mother is not going to be perfectly responsive to the baby. So now this object is inside the mind, but it gets split off into different parts. Three different parts, actually. Kind of looks like a baseball. I can't wait for pitchers and catchers. So part of this object becomes what's known as the exciting object. Then you have the what do you call it?
Depriving.
Now that's, this is the rejecting object down here.
Gratifying.
Was it gratifying? Yeah,
I think so. I have gratifying, enticing, beautiful. Exciting, rejecting, I
think? Yeah,
the
exciting, rejecting, I think gratifying is the third one,
yeah.
Right?
But those, there's the object and then there's the piece of the ego. There are two different things.
Yeah, the central ego
right.
links to the gratifying object.
Gratifying, yeah.
The libidinal ego links to the exciting object, and the anti-libidinal ego links to the rejecting object. So as you can see, the ego then is split into three different sections, and the object, this is the object in the child's mind now, is split into three different categories or sections: exciting, the gratifying, and the rejecting. So let me explain this briefly. The libidinal ego is the ego that carries all the hope for a sustained relationship with the mother. See, the mother has broken the relationship. She went away. She separated from the child. The child internalizes this object, but then splits it off into three different categories. This is the exciting one. This is the mother who entices, I've got the milk, I've got the love, I've got the affection, but I'm not always going to give it to you. So it's kind of like almost dangling in front of the child the wealth of ability to gratify the infant's oral need for object seeking, but doesn't always do it. So it's kind of like an inconsistent mother. And those of you who remember attachment theory from child psychopathology, that's related to really an anxious, resistant attachment, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I was just thinking about this last night. What did I do my free time? What? So, the exciting mother is this mother who sometimes gives her love and affection, but sometimes withholds it for herself. And so, there's this always this promise of gratification, this promise of contact and love, but it's not always, it doesn't always happen. So the libidinal ego is always looking for this exciting object who never really gives it up, but it's always there, the promise of it is always there. The central ego is the part of the ego, it's the healthy part of the ego that actually interacts with the object that actually does give love, give affection, give attention, establishes contact with the baby. And the central ego can also still interact with the external mother as well. So the central ego interacts with both the gratifying object, that's the intrapsychic representation of the mother as being a gratifier, but also the real external mother in the flesh and blood. Okay, then you have the third category of the ego that's been split off, the anti-libidinal ego. And that anti-libidinal ego is connected to the rejecting object. This is the object, this is the aspects of the mother's behavior that are rejecting, that are withholding, that are abandoning, frustrating. And this is where the infant's feelings of helplessness and hopelessness are located. The anti-libidinal ego says, there's no hope in getting anything from this mother. She's useless to me. She doesn't love me. She's not here to make me feel better or to love me. There's no hope in that. She's just, you know, playing with me, playing on my emotions. So the anti-libidinal ego actually can attack both the central ego and the libidinal ego. So the anti-libidinal ego might have a conversation with the libidinal ego. You putz, what are you doing? You think that you're going to get anything from that exciting object? Forget it. She doesn't love you. Has she done anything for you lately? Hell no. Give it up. Don't bother. The anti-libidinal ego is actually the ego, the part of the ego that actually is going to attack the therapist. We talked about negative therapeutic reaction last week, and Klein's interpretation of that or definition of that as being a desire to triumph over the therapist and attack the therapist out of envy, right? Well, Fairbairn doesn't talk about envy, but he talks about the anti-libidinal ego attacking the libidinal ego because believing that the libidinal ego is quite naive, doesn't really understand how this mother works. So the anti-libidinal ego is the part of the ego that's going to sabotage your efforts to help, right? Oh, there you are, high and mighty, sitting in your chair behind your desk. You can't help me. You're here for 45 minutes. Where are you after the session's over? You aren't there for me. What are you going to do for me? You don't love me. I pay you to love me. You're like a prostitute. Right? What?
That is solid
transfer
material. That's good.
Well, it's the anti-libidinal ego talking, right? You don't really love. I pay for your love. This is bullshit. What am I doing here wasting my time? You don't really love me. You have your own family. You have your own kids, your own spouses. You don't. What do you do with me? You're getting a salary. That's all you're doing. You think you can help me? You think you understand my life and my childhood? That's how the anti-libidinal ego talks, and that part of the ego...
What? What you said is funny.
What?
It talks.
It talks. That's how it talks.
Yeah.
It's a talking ego. Dustin.
So like in like real human language, you would just say like the part of the self, part of yourself, that identifies with people who rejected you, or maybe rejecting aspect of the parent.
Identification isn't really part of Fairbairn's language. It's not identification. It's a let me put it this way. It's a reaction to having been rejected in reality. The mother can't always be there. The mother has to go to the bathroom sometimes. You know, I mean, she's not always there. So it's a reaction to feeling rejected. I can't count on you. You are not there for me. You're a rejecting, abandoning object. That's only part of the truth, right? But it's a part that's been cordoned off in the ego. So I'm against object seeking. I'm going to withdraw. I'm going to take my marbles and I'm going to go home because you don't know how to play. You're rejecting me. You're abandoning me, and so I'm withdrawing. And I'm going to try to entice the libidinal ego to do the same thing. Just go home. Why stand there waiting, hoping, longing, yearning? It's not worth anything. The enticing object is just that. They're enticing, they're exciting, but they're not going to give you anything in the end.
You have that object because you know that it does exist, the ability to get
the ability. You know it because there is a gratifying object. That's when the mother really, in real life, does give you the nurturance and love that you need and want. And that's the central ego has a relationship with the gratifying object. But the exciting object is this object that kind of teases and seduces, but doesn't really give in the end. Right?
So are those, like, can you match those with attachment styles?
Well, that's what I was trying to do. This is just my own thinking, but I would guess that...
Because that's ambivalent, right?
This would be anxious ambivalent,
yeah.
And this would be anxious avoidant. Right, I'm going to turn away. I'm going to snub the mother in the strange situation. You can't do anything for me. I know that if I were to crawl to you, you would just sit there and look at me. You wouldn't pick me up. You wouldn't hold me. I've got to deactivate my own attachment system because you're not going to help me deactivate it. And these little babies grow up to be dismissing adults, what we call dismissing. And the psychopathology that's often associated with a dismissing attachment is narcissism, which inexplicably the DSM committee is thinking about dismissing. Ironic that it would occur in such a profoundly narcissistic culture. You know, the irony just is lost on these people, you know. Anywhere else in the world, they would get that joke, but not in this country. Marie?
I just have a question about, you know, you talked about the initial split when the mother separates at some point. And I was just thinking, what is birth then? Because, you know, you are part of the mother, and then you become...
Well, you're not physically, it's true, you're not physically part of her. Now, you know, Fairbairn didn't really, that wasn't really part of what, of his shtick, you know. There are theoreticians who have made a big deal about birth and the trauma of birth. Principally Otto Rank, who was a follower of Freud, who broke away from Freud, and he developed his own theory called will therapy. Will, like in force of will, not in like William. Will therapy, and he was really one of the founders of existential psychotherapy. But he had a whole theory on birth trauma, and that we've all been traumatized by our own births.
But I was just wondering, because you know, you said, because according to this model, if the mother theoretically were to never separate, not be overbearing, but were to just be fine, never separating, then this wouldn't happen. But birth is the first separation. It's unavoidable. So
it's a physical separation. Now the question I pose to you, is it a psychological separation?
I mean, I don't know, but you know, some people think that babies have, some inkling of a consciousness, pre-birth.
You know, it's so early in development, how do we really know what the baby's thinking? We don't. But you know, if Fairbairn were here, what would he say to it? He would say, perhaps there is a psychological separation detected by the newborn, and that is really the origin of the splitting of the ego right from birth, when there's that physical separation inherently causes a psychological separation, which would then bring about the internalization of the object and the splitting off. But there's really not enough experience to have an exciting object and a rejecting object and a gratifying object, you know, minutes after birth, how can you have all three? You'd have to have some experience, I would think, in the real world to have these three different mothers. And Fairbairn was very clear, these are not distortions. These are actually amalgamations of real memories of real behaviors perpetrated by the mother. This is no distortion by aggressive and sexual drives and it's a funhouse of mirrors. That's not Fairbairn at all. He believes that your expectations and your memories and, you know, your objects in your mind are direct descendants of real-life interactions with real-life people.
Well,
Brian?
I mean, you said that the mother first experiences, that the mother's first experience as an object in reality until the needs go unfilled. So the needs would still be filled until birth. I mean, so...
But you would hope that the needs would continue to be fulfilled pretty contingently. You'd want the contingency to be almost at 100%. And then, gradually, as the baby gets older, that contingency percentage drops. Hopefully not precipitously, but very gradually. And Winnicott developed a whole theory around this gradual disillusionment of the infant and introduction to objective reality from this fantasy of infantile omnipotence. So you go from omnipotence gradually disillusioning to objective reality. But that process is a long, gradual, and difficult one for a baby to make. So I think that's kind of what you're talking about. But you start off with 100% contingency. And then as the mother starts to miss a beat, two beats, three beats, and the Mitchell and Black talked about this in very colorful language, I think, that's when you start getting the splitting to try to, the internalization occurs to not feel lonely, to not feel separate from the mother, and to kind of control the badness of the rejecting mother. In that sense, it's similar to Klein. Klein believed that we internalize our bad objects to control them, to exercise control over them. Because if they're inside of us, then we can kind of control them.
Actually, it's funny because I had the thought, well, it's not the mother's fault then. You know, if there's like a natural separation that she had, you know, it just happened. I just had that thought as opposed to the mother choosing how much they're going to gratify or be there, that, you know, there's kind of this occurrence before this happens. And then, so it's like she naturally separates from the baby, and then the baby gets bitter, and then separates her and his mind.
Yeah, I mean, Winnicott talks about the good enough mother. So it's a mother that's not... if you're a mother who's trying to be perfect, that's also bad for development. Because then you become smothering and hovering. You know, you don't want that. But if you're too hands-off, so there's micromanaging a baby, and then there's hands-off managing of a baby, and that's no good either. Because then the baby, that disillusionment gradient becomes very steep. And that's not good either, because if you disillusion a baby too quickly, they have to develop a false self. And we'll talk about that in that psychopathology there. So if you're good enough, not too much one way or too much the other, but just good enough, like Goldilocks, you know, that's what's ideal for infant development, for Winnicott.
But Fairbairn didn't...
No, he
didn't. I thought with Fairbairn, it's like we're all messed up, and... the only way to be right is if mom never leaves you.
Right.
And so, because Fairbairn, like...
No, it's true.
Fairbairn is much more optimistic.
No, Fairbairn doesn't have, like a good psychology. That's
or
what it said
for
about, like...
No. He does have a good... You're thinking of Guntrip. Guntrip was Fairbairn's evil twin.
Yeah. Because Fairbairn
seemed
really optimistic.
I'm not.
Because it said... It says that like the internal object is always bad to Fairbairn. So technically,
there are several.
Make any internal object.
There are several internal objects. One of which is bad.
Right.
That's the rejecting object. But there's also an exciting object isn't very good either. But there is the gratifying object. Right. Now the goal in therapy is to get the patient to exchange the investment in the bad object and then to put it into real, loving, external objects. To kind of restore... See, for Fairbairn, this is very important. The internal objects are all compensatory. You know what a compensatory means? They're substitutes for real interactions. And if you work with, let's say, addictions, right? Addicted people, they live in their heads. They live in their drugs. They substitute drugs for real interactions with people. Right? So Fairbairn's idea is that if you take away these internal objects and replace them with real live human interaction, you don't need these objects anymore. You don't need the fantasies surrounding them in your life. You have real human beings around you. Dustin.
Thing. I'm still confused about the identification because I thought that instead of having to deal with a parent who is bad, that they identify with it, the badness, and make it and think, feel like they are the one who is bad. Isn't that part of it?
Yes, but they're not identifying with the mother's behavior. They think they're bad because the mother's rejected them, so they assume that they've done something wrong.
Okay.
It's not identifying with the mother.
Okay.
It's believing you're bad because that's the only explanation you can deduce and make sense out of your mother's not being there. I mean, the mother might be at work. She's not bad. But you're going to assume that you've done something wrong. Children do this. They do something... I mean, the mother leaves them for perfectly legitimate reasons, but they attribute the badness to them. They weren't good enough for the mother. And so they become identified with the anti-libidinal ego, the part of themselves that withdraws. There's no hope. I can't get anything out of this woman. You know, I'm out of here. I'm withdrawing, I'm taking my marbles, I'm going home because she doesn't want to play. Very pessimistic, cynical, disillusioned. Ever.
So, I guess the part, I mean, what you're saying makes sense to me, but I guess maybe I'm thinking of good and bad instead of consistently accepting versus rejecting. I'm just thinking about the part where you're talking about one of the formative clinical experiences with children who were very attached to parents who were very abusive.
Yeah.
And I would just imagine like that would, I mean, isn't that seen as a rejection even if it is consistent because it's abuse? Or is it just
it's not considered rejecting. I mean, think of it. If you've ever been abused, you know, it's very exciting. You know, and you're getting all the attention. There's something gratifying about it. I mean, we don't talk about that. We all think abuse is bad and you know, nobody wants to be in that situation. That's partly true. Part of you doesn't want to be in that situation, but part of you does. Part of you enjoys the attention you're getting because you're so invested. Mm-hmm. This is the person on whom you depend for nurturance and love. And if this is how they're showing their love, I mean, you think, this is how they show me my love. This is love.
Well, what if they're abusive in the sense that they just completely neglect you? Would that be a different kind of...
There are two ways of looking at it. One is that this rejecting object is a very powerful force. And similarly, the interlibidinal ego would be very powerful as the counterpart
right.
to this. Mm-hmm. The other way of looking at it would be, if they're completely neglecting, then you haven't really attached to them, right? I mean, there has to be some attachment in order for someone to be rejecting.
Right.
If you're not attached to somebody, you can't, you know... If a stranger came in the room right now, someone I've never seen before, and said, and looked at me and said, you know, I will never love you ever again. I'm leaving you. You'll never see me again. Do I really care?
It's a stranger.
I don't have a relationship. We're talking about somebody with whom you have a relationship. So, yes, mothers can be neglecting, but they can't always be neglecting. If they're consistently neglecting, they're never there. Well, then they really aren't being the. They're not the mother. They're a stranger. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So to be neglectful, you have to be loving at times, at least nurturing.
Right.
Otherwise you'd be dead.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, all this stuff is like, it just sounds so depressing because, no, it really does, because you just think, I'm not a mother, but I'm just thinking how much I can screw up my kid by not being this perfect, like in the middle, good enough kind of mom. But then also how that would translate into therapy, and as a therapist, what is that? I don't really see the connection and how it sort of is supposed to play out, because I think about, when I was listening to the lecture from last week, I was thinking about one of the patients that I'm working with, and she has borderline, and she also has an eating disorder, and it was exactly what you were describing, but she pushes everybody away.
Yeah.
And it's like impossible. It's like, but it really is impossible. It feels impossible to even have any kind of interaction with her. Period. Like.
Sure.
And so I.
So she's winning. She's attacking the libidinal ego. She's attacking the central ego, and she's attacking a real object who actually has her welfare
mm-hmm.
you know, in your mind. You want to do good for her. You want to help her.
Yeah,
so for Fairbairn, the goal of therapy is to persuade, really, the patient to attach to the external object. So this patient has to trust you enough that you're not going to be the rejecting object or the exciting object, that you're actually going to give the goods. You actually are going to gratify them libidinally. Which for Fairbairn means showing love, you know, showing up on time, being attentive, listening, creating an environment in which they feel loved and respected. Right?
I hear you. I mean, and my supervisor's working with her individually, and she's trying to do just that. like advocate for her, you know, accommodate her in terms of time, if, you know, she wasn't able to come at a certain time, meet with her at a different time, but she refuses, gets pissed off at her, and no matter what happens, it's like, you see, I told you.
Exhausting. It's totally exhausting. I'm treating this, I talked about this kid before, this encopredic kid, right? I see him four times a week. It's child analysis. And he just turned 11. And he is this anti-libidinal ego personified. That's how he comes into the sessions. It's interesting, though, he never misses a session. He looks forward to sessions, but he assumes this persona in sessions with me. So, and I'm trying desperately to just make contact with this kid. That's my goal. I just want to make contact. Forget interpretations, forget all that stuff. I'm just trying to be a human being making contact with you, and it's so frightening for this kid because he doesn't trust it. He doesn't trust it. He's here. I don't trust the libidinal ego. What the hell do you know? So he sees me, I think, he sees me as an exciting object. I'm enticing him. I'm telling him, you can have a relationship with me. But he doesn't trust it. He doesn't think it's real. So he's trying to sabotage it. So he was playing his iPod in session. And he was playing Green Day, Song of the Century. You guys know that song? No? You guys see American Idiot on Broadway? Highly recommended. Highly recommended. Anyway, you guys know who Green Day is?
Yes.
Am I that old? Really? All right.
That was my first CD.
Oh my God.
I am that old, I guess. So anyway, he's playing this song, right? And he's playing it over and over, and I get a sense that it means something to him, and he's playing it to me for a reason. So that's the central ego. He's trying to establish contact with me as a real person. So it exists. It's in there somewhere. So he's playing the song, and we're also talking about the fact that he plays guitar, and he's going to be in a talent show coming up in a few weeks. All right? So I asked him about the talent show, and it's a group of boys, and he's going to play guitar. He's one of the guitar players. So I asked him, who's writing the music? Who's writing the song that you guys are going to be performing? Oh, some other kid. I said, well, you and I could write it together. Why don't you and I write a song together? And then you can perform that. No, that's not going to work. I'm not going to do that. Okay, all right. So I said, we could do that. And I made up a little rap song.
Let's hear it.
Oh, my God.
Now, I tell you what.
Is that confidential?
I would, but it is confidential only because the rap uses his last name. No, because every rhyme has to do with the last name, so I'm not going to go there. But it was cute, and it referred to our relationship, and he wanted nothing of it. All right, anti-libidinal ego, right?
He told me he was doing
cynical,
it.
Cynical. I'm not having it because you aren't a real object to me. I don't want you to be a real object to me because then I become vulnerable, and you could excite me but not give me the goods. You could reject me. All right. So then we're listening to this song. He's playing it over and over. And I said, I could come back tomorrow because I saw him the next day and give you the guitar chords for the song. You could play the song. You bring in your guitar. You could play it for me. So he said, don't you hear this song? There's no guitar in the song. And somebody pull it up on Rhapsody.com or something, the song doesn't have guitar. It's sung a cappella by Billy Joe Armstrong. There's no guitar. There's a slight drum sound in the beginning. So he's saying, you hear that? There's a really slight drum sound in the beginning, but there's no guitar part. So how could there be guitar chords? I said, you can play guitar to any song. All you need is the guitar chords, even though the song wasn't recorded with it. And I'm trying to explain this. It's impossible. I said, okay, so let's see what I can do. Let's see if I come in tomorrow morning with them. So I went home that night, and I Googled Song of the Century guitar chords, right? And within 3 minutes, I printed out the guitar chords. It's really not hard. So the next morning, I came into session. I said, take a look at this. So he takes it and looks at it. He said, there are no guitar chords here. I said, no, here, look, you see, there's C, that's C major. There's an A. You can play this on your guitar. You really can. No, that's impossible. Did you hear the song? And then he pulls out his iPod and he plays the song again. There's no guitar. He's very, very rigid.
That's so interesting, though. Because what you're trying, like, you're abstracting. He doesn't want a form of the song. He wants the song in the iPod, and you can't give him that.
I mean that's going on. But what about the broader issue? What about the process between him and me? What's going on?
He's testing you, and you're being very consistent. And
here's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to make contact with this kid in reality. And he's pushing me away. I don't want contact with you. I don't want your damn guitar chords. Take them and shove them. You know, I don't want that kind of... You're getting too close to me. This is threatening me. This is scaring me. He puts his arm up and strong-arms me. That's what he does. So I said... So he didn't want the guitar chords. So I said, what would you like me to do with them? He said, you can throw them away. So all the effort that I made was for naught, right? And my counter-transfer reaction was, I feel like shit. Mm-hmm. You know, like, and I was a little angry too, because I had actually, you know, spent some time doing this, and I was thinking, well, this is going to really connect with him, and it didn't work. And so it was very disappointing. So I become the rejected object. So I start feeling disillusioned and pessimistic, and I start identifying with the anti-libidinal ego. So, you know, and I'm in supervision with this case because this is part of my child analytic training. I'm an adult analyst, and now I'm going through the child training program. And so I have a supervisor, and his response to me was, this is going to take a long, long time. It's going to take years for him to trust that I'm not going to hurt him in some way, that I mean well by him, that he can trust that I'm not going to reject him. I'm not going to act like this maternal object and paternal object. It's years. It takes a lot of patience.
Yeah, but do you think in part he's seeing you a bit as a gratifying object? That's why he.
That's why.
Coming,
absolutely.
About coming, so
this isn't the whole truth. Mm-hmm. There is a central ego here who has connected to me, but it's very tenuous. It's a very tenuous connection. But my goal is I'm going to keep trying. I'm going to keep coming. And this is what the supervisor says. Just keep... It's a very Fairbairnian way of working with this kid. Just keep trying. Just keep putting yourself out there, taking risks, trying to make connection with him, make contact with him, as the supervisor says. Eventually, he's going to get a taste of this connection, of reality, and he's going to want more of it. This feels good to be in a relationship with a real person. This kid is so wrapped up in monster trucks. Anybody watch monster trucks on TV or a little bit like Grave Digger and Maximum Destruction, the names of these trucks? You know, he is obsessed, and he lives in this fantasy world of these drivers and the trucks and the world records, and just completely immersed in that to the exclusion of real relationships. His ego is so split off, he doesn't have any energy left for real relationships.
That's really interesting, because usually in the trucks you can't see the driver. Like, you never know who drives those trucks.
Well, he showed me actually a clip, and at the end of the... They do this obstacle course type of thing. It's one of the things they do. And the drivers actually get out of the trucks when they're done, and then a broadcaster comes over with a microphone and interviews them right on the track in front of the crowd, and... So you do get to see them, but you're right. When they're in the truck, you can't really see them. They're just faceless.
That doesn't matter.
Huh?
The driver.
No, it's the truck that matters to this kid.
Is there something to be said for like the destructive power of the truck?
Absolutely. I mean, this kid's an incredibly angry kid who needs to be in control, and he controls other people with his feces. there have been times when he's left my session and I had to spray Febreze in the room. Because it's another very primitive way of him saying, I don't want you around me. I'm going to stink up the place so that you don't get close to me. And he does it with kids, and obviously they're not so nice. And he gets rejected routinely. Has very few friends. Marie.
Yeah, it's like he's testing you to see, like, I'm going to do everything I can to revolt you and push you away, and hopefully you prove yourself to be worthy of what he wants to think of himself. Like, if he thinks he's a valuable person. Then
right, exactly. Not worthy, not whether I'm worthy, but whether he's worthy right. of being loved, I think, would be the Ferbarian way of looking at it. Yeah.
So I'm assuming, like, you need to provide, like, constant, positive...
Regard.
Yeah, but I mean,
Carl Rogers.
So are you gonna? I mean, what are you gonna do? Are you gonna see this kid for the next?
The duration.
Because it might take that long. I mean, it took him 10 years.
As long as it takes.
But you don't plan, like, in a case like this, you don't plan on.
Well, I told. That's a good point. I mean, I told the parents when I first started, which was last May. I said, let's do this for a year, and we'll reevaluate. If you want...
Did the kid have that choice?
Yeah, I mean, he's part of this, mm-hmm. sure. But the parents are ultimately the ones who decide whether he continues or not.
Did the kid know that...
Absolutely, okay. Absolutely.
How old is he?
He just turned 11. Last week, actually. So, yeah, I mean, he knew... And the parents knew that we would do this for a year and then we'd reevaluate and see where we're at, and if they feel like they want to continue, you know, we can continue. But if they feel like this isn't helpful, we can go back to, you know, once a week or whatever, which is what I had been seeing now. So, Eva.
So is the idea that eventually, assuming that you two have this relationship and you're this real... person opposed to this internalized object, that it's going to somehow generalize to other people?
That would be the goal, that
where
this object in reality would be me.
Mm-hmm.
If he can have a relationship with me or with a real person, that may be other real persons he could also risk mm-hmm. having relationships with. Right? But it all starts with me.
But, I mean, I'm assuming that it's not that every person or any person puts up with everything.
No, that's, I mean, that's precisely it, Eva. I mean, we're here, I'm training you, and you guys are getting good training here in this program to be able to put up with this
right.
shit.
Yeah,
so
really.
To speak, literally.
But, so then let's say that he gets to this point with you whenever. If other people aren't as, you know, unconditionally positive and accepting, then does that mean that he's not able to generalize that?
No, I think, I mean, the way I read Ferbarian is that what this kid needs is a taste that real objects can respond to him with love and not rejection or enticement, right?
So once
once he tastes that,
yeah.
he's going to want more. He's going to want to look for it in other real objects,
mm-hmm.
not objects in fantasy, but in reality. That would be the goal in Ferbarian treatment. That's not satisfying.
No, it makes sense, but it's just sort of a recognition of his own worthiness with him?
Yeah, I think so. Right, that the central ego... begins to integrate with these other aspects of the ego to become, the goal is to become a harmonious ego again,
mm-hmm.
which is where you were when you were born.
Mm-hmm.
The harmonious whole ego, that's the goal.
Right.
And so this splitting
mm-hmm.
has to lessen and eventually dissolve into an integrated ego again. And to do that, you've got to integrate some of this pessimism and some of this naivete into a central ego that has real experiences with real gratification, with real objects. And the central ego is going to want more of that. And it's going to realize, you know, the pessimism that I had really isn't warranted. Because I am full of love. I can give love and I can receive love.
Can you involve
the
parents in this?
I do to a limited extent, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, I just told the mother a few weeks ago that I felt she was being too negative. I mean, this kid can't do anything right, and about 3 months ago, she threatened to send him to military school. So, you know,
he's
you can
11,
see...
Huh?
Huh?
He's 11.
Yeah. Yeah, and I had to talk her out of it. I mean, you know, this kid didn't get this way just because he was born this way, all right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when Fairbairn talks about deficient caregiving,
yeah.
Right?
No, this is pretty extreme.
So, you talk about the rejecting object paired with the anti-libidinal ego, who is cynical about any kind of connection, you can see why he treats me that way.
Mm-hmm. But he still shares things with you. He shares his monster traps.
Right, that's
thoughts.
The central ego talking, right? The two different voices.
Mm-hmm.
You like that. Right.
Wouldn't Enkaprisis in a way also be sort of connected to this? Because I know that Enkaprisis at its core begins usually from withholding, not from, right? Most Enkaprisis starts with the withholding.
Right, until such time when I think he's feeling threatened by genuine connection, and that's when he poops.
Right. So the withholding was maybe his first anti-libidinal reaction, sort of, a little bit. Like, okay, you know, I'm not going to give you anything. I guess I'm thinking a little bit back to Freudian theory, too, like, as, you know, the anal stage being, like, the first gift kind of thing. So, like,
right.
The withholding.
Right. You have to think about feces for Fairbairn as being a mode of relating or unrelating, right? It's a mode of relating. Everything for Fairbairn was oral, though. So even he interpreted the anal and phallic zone, erogenous zones, as really metaphors for the oral. So intercourse is the gratification of oral needs for Fairbairn. He didn't see it as a zone in its own right, like Freud did. Something I actually disagree with Fairbairn on, but Adit.
It sounds like what you described, that you were really working hard to do something.
Oh man,
right.
It's exhausting.
And the view is just as if almost you give him opportunities to reject it. He's like, let's write a song together. No. Let me get you
yep.
to the chords. No. It's like, I don't know, it sounds like he is.
Oh, it's sadomasochistic.
Oh, really?
I mean, well,
sorry.
That's what it is. He's the sadist and I'm the masochist. That's the role, those are the roles that we inhabit. Now, I'm not using Fairbairnian language right now in describing it that way, but that's what's going on. But
how it feels like.
Yeah, but Fairbairn would say that's what's necessary to get to a point where he can risk establishing contact with a real external object instead of the objects in his head.
Just be there and not.
And
I don't know.
And do what?
I don't know.
Sit like a bump on the log?
I could do it. The other thing is, like,
I mean, working with kids also requires just a lot more energy than working with adults. I mean, just.
Yeah.
Immeasurably more amounts of energy in working with kids. You know, it's nice, you know, if you're doing adult psychoanalysis, you sit back in your armchair and you listen and you might take a nap and then you wake up and then you say something really ingenious and then you fall back asleep again until the end of the hour, right? Child therapy, psychodynamic therapy is completely different. You're involved, you're assuming characters, you're involved in the play, you're on the floor, you're, I mean, Chrissy knows. Right?
Yeah.
Michelle knows. They were two of my supervisees who had child cases. I mean, it's a lot of work.
The kid that I saw last year.
Right.
He is not so much. I know that he did it more in the previous year, but he would run to the bathroom suddenly. And one time he had an accident. And now that you talk about it, but perhaps we were I felt that we were very close. And I certainly adored him and loved giving her the beginning.
I don't think it was mistakable. So maybe at this specific moment, it was just after he was asking her.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this kid that I'm referring to, you know, has an Asperger's-like quality in some respects. He's not Asperger's, but he has that kind of quality, and so obviously your kid was formally diagnosed with that.
Yeah, but he was less rejected because running to the bathroom is yes. Like pooping yourself in the mirror.
Right, right. No, and you're right.
I didn't feel that it was rejecting me so much as like not being able to
continue. More frightened.
Yeah.
Yeah. Frightened of connection, whereas my kid seems angered by my attempts at connection with him. So that's an interesting difference between the two kids. That's a kid, the kid that Adi is talking about is a kid I supervised several years ago, so I know that case very well. Michelle?
I guess I just have a hard time understanding if this child makes this one connection with you, but he still has rejecting parents. Like, to me, I just, like, can't...
Right, okay, so Fairbairn talked about this adhesiveness of the of the libido to the bad objects. Mm-hmm. You know, for Fairbairn, the central dilemma of psychopathology is you're attached to bad objects, right? There's this attachment from the anti-libidinal ego to this rejecting object, and also this libidinal ego attached to this exciting object. You're not getting anything, but you're still attached. So the question is, how do you get detached and reattached to somebody else? And, you know, Fairbairn isn't completely clear about that, but from my understanding of what he says in his writings and the interpreters that we read for today, the idea is to introduce them to the possibility of a connection with a real-life person that isn't going to reject them or excite them or seduce them, but is really going to gratify them and really genuinely loves them.
But if they reject it again, isn't that just like kind of negating everything?
Sure. So it's very important that you as a therapist don't reject them.
But like, so if they make connection with you and then they make they try to connect with other people and they generalize it to other people and then they reject him.
But if the parents are kind of still like rejecting and alongside this acceptance, then isn't there room for both possibilities to
the goal of the therapy is to get him to withdraw his attachment from the parents and put it in the therapy session. I represent a new object. I'm an object he's never seen before. If he connects to me, he'll be connected to a real live external object for the first time in his life. Once he gets a taste of that, he's going to be able to risk maybe forming a new relationship with his parents. In reality, forming new relationships at school with his peers. In reality, forming a relationship with his teacher. In reality, instead of relying on fantasies of friendships in his head, or relying on fantasies of parents in his head. This kid is very unrelated. So the goal would be to get a taste of what a real connection is like with me. Once he's done that, then he can risk establishing real relationships with real people, including his parents. Kathleen?
Don't you think that this, I just planned out your whole therapy in my head.
Oh, okay. Can I take notes?
Yes, please do. I'm going to give you the answer to all of this, because I'm so great with child therapy. No, I'm just thinking, like, I definitely see what you're saying about, like, the idea would be that he would have symptom remittance also that would allow him to start making those connections with other people. But if his parents kind of suck, wouldn't it be best to, like, get him to that point and then still see him while he's growing up?
His parents suck?
You can,
what do you mean?
Don't his parents kind of suck?
Well, in my mind, they do.
I mean, they're not great parents, are they? I mean,
no, they're not.
They're negative, and so I'm just thinking, like, if you can get him to the, I mean, he's at a low functioning level right now. You can get him to the relational level. Wouldn't it be best then to like let him keep you in his life so that he can then be at more of like. So that when he's a teenager and he's higher functioning but his parents are still awful, he can go to you and process that then?
Well, this treatment is going to be long.
That's good. I feel better about that.
Yeah, it's going to be a long...
I'm worried about him. Well, like, if you lasted for a couple of years and then he loses you when he's 13 or 14, like, that's...
I mean, that's the trauma that all child therapists go through that you don't go through as an adult therapist, that you're not in control. I mean, you're not in control as an adult therapist. If a patient wants to leave, they want to leave, right?
Right.
But at least you know that the adult is making that decision for themselves.
Yeah.
If a child really, 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 really badly wants to work with you and the parents don't like you or they decide they want to move away or whatever, or the finances don't work out, they can take that kid and yank them right out of treatment.
Yeah, and I think of my case from that you supervised.
Yeah.
That's like heartbreaking because the kid never was able to make a connection with me because his parents never had any recently interacted.
And yet you sensed that the child wanted to wanted to come to therapy. See, sometimes the parents get threatened. Like, you're gonna develop a relationship with my child that I can't have because I'm an a-hole. You know, I don't have the psychological skills to develop the kind of relationship with my child that you can, because you're higher functioning, you have all the training, you have all the resources, you can do this, and I'm jealous of you because you're going to usurp my role in my child's life, and I don't like that, and I'm going to prevent that from happening. So I'm going to yank this kid out of treatment. I'm not going to tell you that. I'm going to make up some excuse. I don't have the money. I think you're a lousy therapist. I can't come anymore because it doesn't fit into my schedule, whatever. But the real reason is that they're threatened by you because you're going to develop a relationship with this kid that is different from any other kind of relationship they've ever had in their lives. And you're going to give them something new, something delicious, something that tastes great, something that is filling, but they didn't have at home. And that's extremely threatening to a parent, especially a bad parent.
Not even good enough.
Kristen.
You said a few minutes ago how important it is as a therapist that while you're connecting with this kid or whoever it is you're seeing, that you make sure that you don't reject them at any point. So,
I'm talking about from a Fairbairn. I'm Fairbairn today.
Okay.
I'm not saying I agree with that.
So
I'm Fairbairn today.
From Fairbairn. So it seems inevitable that at some point in the next couple of years, if you see someone 4 days a week, that you will fail them somehow. You might get sick for a week and not be able to
see them. Go on vacation.
Or go on vacation, or get stuck in traffic and late to a session. It seems inevitable that you would fail them. So would Fairbairn say that therapy is screwed from that point on because you've...
Well, he would say that you try very hard to repair the connection between the central ego and me, the real object in real life. Now, Winnicott would say, this is not Fairbairn, Winnicott would say, the child has to be gradually disillusioned by this perfect contingency. Like, I'm there every day, well, 4 days a week at a particular time. I never miss a session, right? But that can't go on forever, right? I have to take vacations. I have to have time for myself. I can't see this kid 7 days a week. I see him only 4 days a week. You know, I'm not there in his life all the time. So I gradually have to disillusion this kid away. He thinks he's created me. Right? Did you read that little vignette about Winnicott? He's seen this woman who he wanted to establish the feeling, the sense in this woman of infantile omnipotence. So he'd look out his window when she was coming to his house for the therapy, because he had a home office, right? And just at the moment when she was ready to open the door, he would open the door. So it appeared as though she created him and his opening the door.
That's creepy.
I would never do that. But that's Winnicott, you know, and it follows from the theory, right? He wants to give her a sense, an illusion, the illusion that she is creating him, that he is under her total control, and that she has some impact on him, right? She's all-powerful. She created him. He opened the door for her. But she willed it. Because as she's opening the door, he's pulling it from the other side. And he would do this every session. And he was probably seeing her 5 times a week, right? So... But to give the illusion, so then he can gradually disillude. You see, first you have to embody the patient with a sense of omnipotence, an illusion of omnipotence before you can disillusion them. Disillusionment is disillusion, right? So first you have to give them the illusion, and then you disillusion them gradually, so they can gradually become introduced to objective reality. So eventually, I assume this woman would be opening her own door, and he wouldn't be standing there, right? Because then she can tolerate that reality. Reality is that we're not there contingently for everybody at all given times, right? I might be a few minutes late for supervision, but you're not going to get frustrated by that because you're mature, right? People are late sometimes, right? So there's not a perfect contingency. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Yeah,
I answered it kind of in a Winnicottian way.
Right. Yeah, it's hard to conceptualize it from a Fairbairn, I guess.
Right, Fairbairnian.
Fairbairnian, yeah.
Right. I think Fairbairn would say you just want to keep trying to reestablish that contact with the central ego. Right. Should we talk about Winnicott? Real quick, Dustin.
Can we take a quick break?
Yeah, 5 minutes, how's that?
Okay.
Because we took a long break with the technical difficulties.
Yes. Is that a real question? Like, do we answer it honestly?
I mean, he asked me that last year. This year was not the one we did. It's come to the bottom, that's it. It's a really nice facility. It's much nicer than that.
Yeah.
I remember that. Yeah, no, I said it was a more intense population than we used to work in.
Right.
But obviously, every year, it's going to be more and more. He wasn't scared.
The sound is really nice on the phone.
Do you want to send a message via the phone chat?
Mm-hmm. And just plus.
Pitchers and catchers reference. around here. I do, because I'm so sports deprived. I have so many like comments, and then I'm like, oh, I forgot where I am. No one gets it.
Well, you know, in a program that's filled with women, my sports references often fall on deaf ears.
Yeah. This, I remember Paper Don't Play.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Yeah, I get it.
I don't remember the context I said that, but I do remember saying
it. Yeah, I don't remember either. I just remember being amused at it. I'm anti Super Bowl this year. Like, I don't even want to watch. I'm so angry.
All right, so let's talk about Winnicott before we end. So once again, the central conflict for Winnicott is separation and the gradual disillusionment of the mother as being kind of an extension of the infant to being a separate person. So it's this gradual separation. Into a child and a mother. With the relationship between them, of course. So getting from here to here is called disillusionment. And it has to be done gradually, and if it's not done gradually, but precipitously, so if the disillusionment,
So disillusionment is a separation of...
Yeah, it's the gradual understanding that I'm not part of my mother anymore, and she's not under my complete control. So if this is omnipotence. And this over here is, you know, objective reality. that is going to frighten the child. The child's going to have to assume certain caregiving functions for themselves prematurely before they're mature enough to really handle that kind of understanding that the world doesn't operate when they say it does, that it's not under their control. This very precipitous drop. Now, what kind of a maternal behavior might create something like that?
Neglect.
Neglect, right?
Fervorizing,
I like that. Yes.
You know what you're talking about.
Correct. So, what happens here? The infant gets frightened and has to protect itself. So it develops what's known as the false self. The false self complies with the demands of the mother and soothes the infant when the mother's not there. It takes care of all of those kinds of functions that it really shouldn't have to do. But the false self exists to protect the true self. The true self for Winnicott was the seat of a person's vitality, their passion, their life force, which is very fragile and delicate and vulnerable and needs protection, especially in caregiving environments where the mother is engaging in impingement. An impingement for Winnicott is a circumstance in which the mother is either getting into the face of the infant and disturbing the infant's quietude, right? Disturbing their fantasy, their reverie, whatever word you want to use. They're getting there and disturbing it, or an impingement is also not meeting the infant's needs. That would be the other direction. So either of those kinds of behaviors, it's considered an impingement, and the greater the number of impingements, the more solidified the false self has to be. False self is protecting this true self, and the true self, according to Winnicott, is just waiting for the environmental conditions to be just right so that the true self can show its face, metaphorically speaking, can reveal itself. It's not going to get shot down. It's not going to be impinged upon. It's going to allow its true creative, vitality, playful side to show itself. The false self will no longer be necessary because the false self exists only to comply with the demands of the external environment. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So the goal of therapy for Winnicott is to provide the conditions under which the true self can not only reveal itself, come out from hiding, but also flourish. So Winnicott did very little interpretation. He did a lot of sitting with a patient in their distress, listening, being attentive, being on time, opening the door for the patient, you know, allowing for the true self to emerge out of its cocoon of a false self. The true self is cocooned within the false self, and it's just waiting for an opportunity to come along, and that opportunity is obviously psychoanalysis for Winnicott, to be released and metamorphose into a fully flourishing true self that can risk being out there in the world and not have to be hidden away, squirreled away in a cocoon of a false self. That's Winnicott's contribution. Now, Winnicott believed that aggression, again, not a drive, but a force that is useful, a life force actually, it's useful in separating from the mother so that the true self can actually live. So the self is going to attack the mother. Now the mother has several options, and I'm talking about attacking in fantasy. It's no longer Fairbairn. Winnicott, like Klein, believed that fantasy life was very healthy and wholesome and necessary for development. So the mother, upon getting attacked, I don't care whether it's the mother biting her breast, I mean the child biting the mother's breast. Huh? Yeah, that'd be child abuse, wouldn't it? The child biting her breast or screaming in her ear or peeing in her face or whatever it is, whatever kind of onslaught or attack the baby is engaging in, the mother has several possibilities. One is to tolerate the abuse of the child, right? Sit there and just take it. That would be one option. Another option is to retaliate. The mother could slap the kid. Another option is for the mother to crumple, right, and just dissolve into a puddle of tears herself and just become fragile and kind of disintegrate in front of the child's onslaught. That's another option. The final option is the mother could withdraw her love. Just take it away and leave the child alone in her or his attack and aggression. Depending upon what the mother does in that situation, the baby's going to have a reaction to whatever the mother does. Obviously, the ideal is for the mother to take it, to take one on the chin, to take one for the team. That's a sports metaphor.
Would you qualify that as ignoring it?
Yeah.
Well, ignoring in the sense of, to use Beyond's metaphor, to contain it. Winnicott's metaphor was a holding environment. I'm going to hold that aggression to give the infant the awareness that my aggression, no matter how hard I try, this mother is going to survive. She's a survivor. So my aggression must not be that bad. I must not be that bad. Hey, I'm lovable in spite of my aggression. My mother survived my attack. She's still there. She's different. She's an external object now because she survived. I wanted to destroy her. I'm not omnipotent. So I have to live with the fact that I'm not omnipotent. I couldn't destroy her. But, hey, she survived. She's still taking care of me. She still loves me. She's now an external object. But what I get out of that is that my aggression is not so toxic or destructive. She's going to survive. That's a very important lesson for a baby to learn. But if the mother either retaliates or crumples or withdraws, the infant learns a very different lesson. The lesson the infant learns is, my aggression really is pretty powerful. I'm pretty dangerous. I am omnipotent. And see, reinforcing the belief of omnipotence doesn't serve the purpose of development toward independence and autonomy. It actually reinforces the infantile, omnipotent, dependent relationship. The belief that I'm all-powerful doesn't move you toward maturity, it moves you backwards. So, for Winnicott, it's important that the mother be preoccupied. And many feminists have had a field day with Winnicott because, what does that mean? I guess that means that mothers need to stay at home and just spend 100 hours a day, you know, tending to the kid. So, but he really believed in maternal preoccupation. That was a term he used. And the mother, and he likened it to being psychotic. The mother has to have this almost psychotic obsession with the infant to create the illusion that the infant can control the mother's every move. Gradually, the mother disillusions the child, but the infant has to have that experience of omnipotence in order to be gradually disillusioned and not be disillusioned so precipitously, like the chart there that I drew. Kathleen.
I'm just wondering, Winnicott's language is very difficult to deal with because...
Winnicott's...
Language.
Language.
I'm not sure all the time, what he really is
implying. So, like, the idea that, like, the choices that you presented that the mom would do, I'm thinking, okay, if my infant, and I've seen mothers do this, like, if my infant bites me, like, that's the end of the feeding for right then, and you say, no, that hurts, and you, like, take a break, and then you try again. So would that, like, does that work for Winnicott, or is that retaliation?
I think, honestly, if I were Winnicott, I would say it depends upon the age of the baby you're talking about. If it's a two-month-old, no, you should take it.
Yeah.
If it's a,
well, they don't have teeth then.
If it's a 12-month, right. So if it's a 12-month-old, maybe you would take a break and then come back, and then the baby goes, oh, I didn't destroy you. I thought I did. You went away there for a little while, but you're still here. Huh. My aggression didn't destroy you. You survived my, you know, most fervent attacks. So I'm not so powerful as I thought I was, but that's actually a good thing because I need you around to survive, which makes the baby enter into what Winnicott called the stage of concern. Remember, he doesn't call it a depressive position, but it's very, very similar. Concern is his term for depression, really. He called it concern. The infant then becomes concerned for the mother, because, you know, he's given the mother everything that he's got. Like in the paranoid schizoid position for Klein, and then Klein said, you know, that the infant has this epiphany, ah, the mother I've been destroying in fantasy is really the mother who's also been loving me, and I'm feeling depressed and guilty. For Winnicott, that same kind of aha moment exists, but it's not between a bad mother and a good mother, it's between the mother who is the mother who deals with the baby when the baby's excited and upset and frustrated versus the mother who's there kind of in the background as the kind of like background music while the infant is alone in their thoughts or fantasy or whatever. The mother is always kind of there, just kind of in the background, hovering, but not in an intrusive way. So the infant has to integrate these two versions of the mother. The caregiver's two functions. As an object mother, which is the mother who handles a baby when he's frustrated, excited, whatever, and then the object mother and the caregiving mother, that's the mother who's just kind of there when the baby is in a more quiet state of mind. So they have to integrate these two mother functions together, and it's the integration of these two mothers. And the belief that the mother can't be destroyed by the infant's attacks that propels the baby into the stage of concern, which is analogous to the depressive position with some modifications based on Winnicottian ideas. But depression and guilt really weren't part of the theory. It's more, I'm concerned for you, I love you, I care about you. You know, I want to see you okay. I'm glad that you survived. Even though it means that I've given up some of my omnipotence, I can't control you, but I'm learning that I can't control you, but I'm still happy that you're around because I do still need you. So for Winnicott, people move from a state of infantile dependence to a state of mature dependence, very similar to Fairbairn. And all the middle school theoreticians, you're moving from more dependence to less dependence, but you never become independent. That's a myth. That's the problem I have with one of the problems I have with Mahler's theory. There's no interdependence at the end of the rainbow. At the end of the rainbow, you're John Wayne in her theory. That's problematic for me. Let's see. Yeah, the capacity for concern is what Winnicott calls it, the capacity for concern. Any questions about, that's very brief. I'm sorry I spent more time on Fairbairn and less time on Winnicott than I wanted to. I wanted to be more equal, but we spent more time on Fairbairn, I think because of the case example I gave you guys. Because if the case presentation, I think just naturally more fits a Fairbairnian perspective than a Winnicottian one.
I was wondering, at what age would Winnicott, because I know he like wrote, you know, suggested, I mean, to parenting kind of suggestion. Mm-hmm. At what age is the mother allowed to start reacting in a non-holding way to the child's
parents? Yeah, I mean, Winnicott would say, it's the wrong question. For Winnicott, you have to be so attuned. Now, he didn't use the word attunement. That's a Daniel Stern term. But Stern is basically Winnicottian. You have to be so attuned to this infant that you're reading their signals. And you'll know when they're ready to be disillusioned. And by the way, it has to be gradual. It can't be...
Well, yeah, it can't be just like...
Right.
Bam.
But you'll know when the baby's ready. Winnicott would say, all I'm doing is I'm helping mothers to rely on their gut.
No, so no suggestion of like 6 to 8 months, 8 to 12 months.
No, he wasn't.
Not that.
He's not Dr. Spock. He's not Barry Brazelton. He's Winnicott.
Yes, he is.
So it was important for him to emphasize to mothers, you do what you feel is meeting the needs of the infant in the moment. You have to be preoccupied with this child. Read this child like you read a book from cover to cover. You know, you got to really know the child inside and out.
I'm wondering what his relationship was with his wife and whether he, like, idolized her and, like, if she was, like, just psychic.
He didn't have children. He was a pediatrician.
He sees women kind of as psychic, like...
Psychic or psychotic?
Well, then they should
be
psychotic.
Note, it's 7 o'clock.
Huh?
Seeing the funny
thing. Right, he's really advocating a period of temporary masochism for the mother. Absolutely. And, you know, feminists have a field day attacking Winnicott for that. He was also very instrumental in advocating that women... return from the workforce and get back in the homes and have babies after World War II. He went on the BBC radio broadcasts and really was a mouthpiece of propaganda for the British government. So you got to know that about Winnicott as well. And he's really never been forgiven for that by feminist psychoanalysts. Very rare that you see someone base feminist psychoanalytic theory on Winnicott. You don't see it very often.
Did he say sorry?
What?
Did he say sorry?
I don't think he lived long enough. He died in 71, and when did Friedan's book get published? Was it 73? Or was it 61?
I thought it was 60-something.
Yeah, it was 60-something.
Yeah,
63? He died in 71, so maybe it didn't reach across the pond, as they say, in time. For him to make an apology and amends. All right, see you next week.
What?
I don't want to drop the end bomb if you don't want to go. Why, you don't want to go if I don't go?
Did you just say Bev?